From the noisy studios of Univest at Lehigh Valley Public Media in Bethlehem, PA, it is time for another extremely loud episode of Chemical-Free Horticultural Hijinks, You Bet Your Garden. You may have heard the news by now. Two massive broods of periodic cicadas are due to emerge in a few weeks. Trillions of them. I'm Mike McGrath, and on today's show, we'll tell you how to prepare for this extraordinary invasion. Plus, forager chef Alan Burgo joins us to explain how you can make a delicious syrup from your own pine trees. And your fabulous phone call questions, comments, tips, tricks, suggestions, and formidable but fanciful felicitations. So stay right where you are, cats and kittens, because it's all coming up faster than you picking pine cones for pancakes right after this.
J.L. Hudson Seeds has supported You Bet Your Garden and enthusiastic growers for more than 25 years. To learn more about the world's most eclectic seed company, visit jlhudsonseeds.net.
Welcome to another thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden from the Univest Studios at Lehigh Valley Public Media in Bethlehem, PA. I am your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up very shortly on the show, we have the forager chef, Alan Burgo, who will tell you how to make your own syrup that's like maple syrup, but not, because you make it from pine cones. And it is a fascinating project. It's easy to do. And you make a substitute for a very expensive product, which is real maple syrup. So stay tuned. You don't want to miss that. But now it's time for your fabulous phone calls at 888-492-9444. James, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thanks, Mike. Nice to talk to you.
It's nice to talk to you, James, at least until maybe I find out what your question is. Where are you, man?
I'm in Lansdowne, Pennsylvania, close into the city.
So Lansdowne, not Lansdale.
It's down, not Dale, yes.
Oh, okay. Downhill and down.
It's by Upper Darby, and I can see the, if I stand in the middle of my street, I can see the buildings of Center City.
Okay. Yeah, the city tends to be laid out that way very nicely. A lot of good views of the true center of the city from various locations. All right. Enough chit-chat. What can we do you for?
Well, we've been in this house for over 30 years. And the first neighbors we had, he hated mowing his big back lawn. Most of our houses have long, narrow, deep, narrow lots. And he decided to get something that would help him not have to mow the lawn. And he put in a whole lot of plugs of what I think was zoysia.
Oh, you're in a world of trouble.
That's what I was. It has spread, and all the lawns are in the back are divided by fences. But it went under his fence.
Oh, yeah.
And got into my raised bed.
Yep.
And it's just taken over. And it's just awful stuff. It choked out an entire. We have two 16-foot raised beds.
Mm-hmm.
4x16.
Okay. And very good.
Divide, and this one, the one closest to the fence, is completely useless now.
Okay. All right, listen. Zoysia, although in the ads it pretends to be a grass that is native to Florida, it is not. That's simply where all the plugs and sod is grown. It's originally from, I believe, Vietnam, and it is a warm season grass. That's why it's probably turning brown on you, or is completely brown already, because it is not adapted to cold winters. So the grass sends all its nutrients down to the roots to kind of hide out, and then greens up again in the spring. the further south you are, the more months of greenery you'll have. If you're up in Minnesota or Wisconsin, you can't go on vacation because you might miss it. But
well, we had enough heat this summer to encourage it to spread rapidly, but it's been pretty chilly the last couple weeks.
Yeah, which is to your advantage. It is going to go completely dormant, and the time to get rid of a warm season grass is in the winter. Now, there's no easy answer here because the problem has been marching on for decades. If this was a neighbor who had just moved in, planted zoysia plugs, you could take him to court and you would win because it is illegal to put plants in the ground on your property if they're going to spread to adjoining properties. Big example, of course, running bamboo, but zoysia grass is right up there. So it may seem impossible, but the colder it gets and the browner the zoysia gets, the more easy it will be, easy being a relative term, to dig it up out of the raised bed. Then you need to stop the spread. And what I'm going to recommend here is a horticultural product called Rhizome Barrier.
Rhizome barrier.
Yeah, because it's spreading by underground rhizomes.
Yeah.
And this is used to contain running bamboo, but it should work wonderfully well against zoysia grass. What you would do, and you may, you know, for instance, if you're going to have this stuff professionally installed, have them dig out the zoysia grass too. But then around the outskirts of your raised bed that's been taken over, you would have them install rhizome barrier. They would use a trenching tool, a ditch digger, to go down X number of inches, feet, you know, maybe a foot and a half, something like that. I would want to look that up. And surround the bed with it, and that should stop the growth towards the bed after that. It's not going to replicate in any other way. It's just going to try to force your door down and, you know, take over your TV remote.
It has already taken over. We have a compost thing that sits on the bare ground.
Mm-hmm.
It's taken that over too.
Well, this...
I don't want to use that compost.
No. Don't worry about that. What you want to do, again, while the zoysia is totally brown, you can probably lift it out of the compost. And then just turn it upside down and leave it sit out on a non-grassy area, on like a driveway or something like that.
Yeah.
Until it's totally... decimated, having its roots exposed to the cold over winter will destroy it. And then, you know, I would certainly mix it up, shredded with shredded leaves, but you don't have to. This is enough of an invasive that you're perfectly welcome to throw it away. Make sure you disguise it well because it might not be street legal to do so. But the compost, that's going to be easy. You're going to be able to pull that out with gloved hands. Getting the bed back is going to require a barrier to stop the zoysia from getting back in there.
All right. This sounds like a lot of work.
Well, it is. Same thing for people who watch bamboo encroach on their property for like 10 years and then... you know, floorboards start lifting up and everything goes to heck. And then they want to address the problem. And it's like any other problem. The longer you wait, the more it's going to cost.
The dirt that's in the raised bed, should I toss it? Should I get it down to the bottom of the raised bed and then put in new fabric or something?
Well, the fabric underneath the bed, you know, I would not depend on. It is the sides of the bed that need to be protected.
Yeah, okay.
Now, as to your excellent question about the soil, I would remove that soil. I mean, is it compost enriched soil? Is it been?
Oh, it's. I've been mulching my leaves for years and putting them in the composter and or leaving them in plastic bags, or just putting them as dressing on the top of the garden.
Okay. Then what I would suggest is you get a dedicated composter that is not sitting on the grass or the dirt. Again, a driveway or, you know, pathway would be ideal, and pile the soil into there and then wait until like June. If there are any rhizomes that were missed, they'll start to sprout and you'll know what to do. But otherwise, you know, I think it's a decent crapshoot to isolate it and see if you can recover the soil.
Yeah, it's been pretty productive soil, but okay.
All right.
Okay. Yeah, I'm gonna see if I can find somebody who would do this, like one of my grandsons.
Well, rhizome barrier is tricky. It really can't have any gaps in it. It's like assembling a gas grill. The first time, it took you 8 hours, and you had 14 parts left over.
But, and I cut my hand 6 times.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. But by the time you put your fourth gas grill together, you do it in 20, 30 minutes, and it's much better quality. So
yeah.
I do not recommend amateurs trying this. It's
All right.
You know, it's a very sophisticated material.
All right.
But it should be once and done.
Is it like flashing or something?
Yeah.
Is it metal?
It is sometimes metal. It is sometimes, I believe, a form of polycarbonate. You're going to have to do some research here. But if you look up rhizome barriers, it'll tell you what you need to know.
Okie doke. Thank you, Mike.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and remind everybody out there that I will return to the Allentown Public Library on Tuesday, May 7th at 6:30 to discuss whatever is on your gardening mind. But don't go thinking up questions just yet, because we'll be right back with the forager chef explaining how to make delicious syrup from your own fresh pine cones. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from the Univest Studios at Lehigh Valley Public Media in Bethlehem, PA.
This is 91.3 FM, WLVR Bethlehem, WLVR.org.
Welcome back to another thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden from the Univest Studios at Lehigh Valley Public Media in Bethlehem, PA. I am your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, we are about to be invaded by two periodic broods of cicadas. Those are the ones that sleep a long time underground. And there will be trillions of them in the Midwest, South, and up the East Coast quite a bit. So you want to be prepared, especially if you have young trees. And you will be prepared as long as you stay tuned. But right now, it is our pleasure to welcome our special guest, Alan Burgo, the forager chef, author of the Forager Chef's Book of Florida. If you just type Forager Chef into your search engine, you'll find him, and you'll enjoy one of the best designed and written websites I've seen in quite some time, maybe forever. All right, I'm done buttering you up, Alan. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Very much thank you for being here. Now, this all started a couple of, I don't know, weeks, maybe a month or two ago, when a caller told us about Magolio and explained that everything she knew about this syrup you can make at home, she learned from your website. So that sent us there, and I have consumed your website. I wish I could consume some of the syrup, but I'm going to do this spring. So how were you, and I'll just explain that Magolio is like maple syrup, but there's no maples involved. It's mostly pine cones and parts of other evergreens that you make the syrup yourself, and you don't have to tap anything. So, Alan, where did you first discover Magolio?
Well, I worked in restaurants for like 15 years. You get exposed to all kinds of things. And I was working in very, very nice restaurants, so I had access to really interesting suppliers that literally scour the earth looking for the most interesting things that they can sell to chefs. And I was working with a producer, a purveyor called Great Chow here in the Twin Cities, and they had these little tiny bottles of something called Magolio, and it was so expensive. I mean, I'm spitballing here. I want to say it was like $35 for like 4 ounces. So it's a lot of money to pay for a little syrup. And I remember one chef would have us put it on a plate with an eyedropper because it was so expensive. and it tasted good. But eventually I forgot about it for a little bit, and because it was so expensive. And then one of my friends told me about, he brought me a version that he made, and it was kind of weak and there wasn't a lot of flavor. And I forgot about it for a little while until I saw unripe pine cones on a tree. And I thought to myself, maybe we weren't getting them at the right stage or something like that. So I started doing some experimentation because Italians, you know, are very particular about things. They'll say maybe it should only come from the Mugo pine, because Mugolio, the name comes from Pinus Mugo, which is the Mugo pine. And what they do here, and there's other kind of analogous processes around the world, especially in Korea, where they make something called a chong. And the method is the same here. You take whatever your ingredient is, you mix it with twice its weight in sugar. And typically this is going to be like brown, untreated sugar. It has a little bit more moisture in it. Some things, depending on the natural water content of the ingredient, you could use some white sugar or you could use maple sugar, but you mix the ingredient with the sugar, and the sugar draws out the natural moisture of whatever that ingredient is. With pine cones, it draws out the natural water from unripe pine cones. So this is pine cones that are harvested in the spring when they're small enough that you can cut them with a knife. They're kind of soft. You could almost squish some of the small ones between your finger. The exact size isn't really that important. But they should be green. You don't want them to be very firm yet. You have to be able to cut them with a knife. About a nickel is about a decent size, nickel or a dime. And the water comes out from the pine cones, mixes with the sugar. The pine cones are covered in natural yeast, and you get this vigorous fermentation. And after about 30 days, then I will scrape this kind of slurry of sugar and pine cones into a pan, and I'll warm it up to melt the syrup, strain out the pine cones, and that is it. But over that 30-day period, it's called a maceration, you get all this kind of transfer of aromas and flavors from the pine cones into the sugar. And, you know, originally, you know, we just thought, oh, it's made with Pinus Mugo. There's not a lot of Mugo pines in my area. There's actually, I only know of one where my friend got the ones that he used. So I started to think of, okay, if I can do it with the Mugo pine, can I do it with spruce cones? Can I do it with balsam fir cones? And I really broke open the door for experimentation here, because you can really make it with just about any unripe pine cone, because they're going to have a comparable amount of natural liquid. And the fascinating thing that I discovered is that every single species of pine or conifer tree that you're harvesting unripe cones from, they all taste different. So a white spruce cone is going to taste a little bit different from a blue spruce cone, but all the spruces are going to have like a citrusy element to their flavor. A red pine cone, which is one of my favorites and kind of the most dependable that I've harvested, they're going to have a strong flavor that I call resinous. It's like deeply piney and rich and earthy.
Like the trees themselves.
Some other ones like, yes. Then balsam fir is probably my favorite, and that is completely different. That one tastes like if you put nutmeg and like allspice and cloves into the syrup. So and then cedars are different too. So all of the species are different flavors.
Well, I have a white pine and that barely survived this last winter. I know you're up in Minnesota, Wisconsin. You guys are used to this stuff, but my plants did not have a good time, but I have enough of it left. I'm pretty sure it's going to cone out. Then I have a couple of other pine trees and evergreen trees that produce cones in my property. So I'm going to do this. And again, I'm so happy to have you on right now because this is the time of year to start looking for the development of young pine cones. And your website about Mogolio is beautifully photographed, and you made me jealous before we brought you on that you had done all the photography and you do your own video. You know, it's like you make your own clothes. What else do you want? I love you have a photograph of pine cones at different stages of maturity. I think there's 7 of them. And the smallest ones are not yet ready. The ones in the middle are probably perfect, but it seemed even the ones that were largest in that photo would be good candidates for this.
Yes, and that was exactly what I was trying to get across there. And the small cones, you can use those cones, like any of those cones could be used except like mature cones that are opened up. The smaller cones, they are actually used in a very special related preserve. This one is from the Caucasus, Eastern Europe, Russia. It's known as a varanyai, and that just basically means like a preserve or a jam. And it's literally called pine cone jam. And for that one, you cook them. I cook them actually in apple cider, and the very, very small ones, like the size of your pinky nail. And you cook that down until the apple cider becomes a syrup. Usually people just use sugar and water. And like something happens, it's not like pectin, but the pine cones thicken the syrup and they get preserved in this apple cider molasses. And you eat the pine cones in this thick, jammy syrup. Like I serve them on toast with a little bit of goat cheese and you literally eat the pine cone. So if you find really small ones, like very, very tiny, that you can use that. That is specifically for the very, very small ones. But you could make Mogolio out of those too.
Now,
you have a wide window of harvesting where they can work.
But again, that's why we have you on right now, because I want our listeners across the country to be looking at their evergreens, at their pine trees, and all those other varieties, and be watching the pine cones. This is, in one sense, almost the same as maple syrup because you have to do all the work in the spring and maybe early summer. But it's not a lot of work. And, you know, maple syrup, good maple syrup, is darned expensive. And the idea that you can make your own delicious, unique syrup. And as you said in your page, make a lot of it and consider giving small jars of it as gifts to your friends and over the holidays.
Yeah, absolutely. There's lots of different things people can do with it. There's one company has started producing it commercially using my recipe. Spruce tips, the young growing tips of spruce trees work too, and that is actually traditional. A guy from Hungary told me that when they do the spruce tip syrup, they take the spruce tips, they mix them with sugar, and then they bury the jar in the ground for a year, and then they dig it up the next year.
Kimchi!
Except made out of spruce and sugar, and it's not spicy, and there's no cabbage, but It's still fermented for a very long time.
Except that, yeah. So, again, you have complete instructions at the Magolio section of your website, which is Forager Chef. I've really urged people, even if they're not planning on doing this, to read that through, drool over the pictures. It sounds like a great thing to do. And the cost benefit to you, the gardener, the consumer, the bottler upper, is enormous compared to maple syrup.
Absolutely.
Are there any pine cones or evergreen tips that you found had a bad taste?
Some of the tips of, black spruce.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I like those. I have liked almost everyone that I've made. They're all just like, they're all a little bit different. You do want to make sure that you know what a U is, because U can look similar and U is poisonous.
Right.
But that's really the only thing to know. But, U is a shrub.
And
fairly easy.
You mentioned this already, but I want to go over it. It's a very simple recipe. In the beginning, let's say with a perfectly immature pine cone, you put it in a mason jar or something like that. The pine cones, you can do it by weight or you can do it by cups. And then you add twice that volume, weight, whatever. I presume there's a lot of wiggle room here.
Yes, there's a lot of wiggle room. You can do it by volume, you can do it by weight. You just mix the pine cones with sugar, put them in a jar, and then after a little while, they reach like a critical point where the water seems to just release en masse. And then like overnight, the pine cones won't be in a bunch of sugar, they'll be sitting in liquid.
Huh, that's amazing. It kind of bursts out in one evening.
It's a gradual process. I mean, there's images of the process showing the process on my website.
And you very specifically specify some type of high quality brown sugar. Like you mentioned turbinado and then all different organic brown sugars. And each different sugar is going to give your syrup a slightly different flavor, right?
Sure. And it's mostly for color and the slight amount of additional liquid that it has. Just white syrup isn't really attractive. So having a brown sugar that has a little bit of that residual molasses in it, it just makes the syrup much more attractive.
I was going to say, we're not fans of white sugar here. And I can see how the brown sugar would really facilitate the taste of the syrup.
Yeah, and an interesting thing to think about is you can make all kinds of colored variations, too. As I mentioned, in Korea, they do something called a chong, which is the same. It is the same thing, but they use a lot of fruits there. So if I took choke cherries and mixed them with the same proportions, you're going to get there's more liquid in them than there is pine cones. So you're going to get this super dark red fermented choke cherry syrup. You could do the same thing with wild blueberries. You could do it with all kinds of fruit. I mean, people have taken it and tried to do it with rhubarb. I mean, it's an interesting rabbit hole to go down, especially if you like fermentation projects in jars, which I don't know anyone who doesn't.
No, I mean, fermentation has been a trend for a while, and I don't see it peaking anytime soon.
No.
Well, listen, you have been the perfect guest. You explain your process and everything so perfectly. This is probably the least I've ever spoken during an interview. And I couldn't be happier because you are a fascinating and talented conversationalist. So once again, I'm going to close this interview down, not because I want to, but because it's perfect. This does not need to be edited, and I want it to fit into the middle segment of the show. So I'm going to go over you one more time. We're talking with Alan Burgo, who is known as the Forager Chef, and you can find him online at foragerchef.com. And we're talking about Magolio, the pine cone syrup that he will walk you through. All you'll have to do is keep an eye on your evergreens and pick the pine cones at either the right time or different times, because you're going to get a different flavor once they're good, between being that middle pine cone in your photograph and being the one on the left. So many ways you can tinker with this recipe.
Yes, absolutely there is. And you can add different flavorings to it. You can add herbs if you want. I use a plant called sweet fern, or there's a plant called spice bush that kind of tastes like allspice and black pepper. Or you can mix different varieties of pine cones together. You can mix red pine cones and spruce tips. You can play around with all kinds of different things to make it your own.
Well, it is fascinating. I'm in love with this idea. I am going to be doing it with my own pine cones, and maybe I'll do a little walk in the woods and find some other ones. But this sounds like a great thing to do in the spring. And I honestly can't wait to try some. So once again, it's Alan Burgo, the Forager Chef, and his website is Forager Chef. And you want to go and read about Magolio. And after you do that, I have a feeling you're going to stay on his website and binge through it. So, Alan, once again, you have been the perfect guest. I can't thank you enough.
Oh, thanks for having me on. It's great.
All right. Well, you take care, and I'll meet you in Mongolia land. All right.
I'll
thank you
later.
So much. Bye-bye for now. Well, it's time for me to take a little break and remind everybody out there that I will return to the Allentown Public Library on Tuesday, May 7th at 6:30 in the evening to discuss whatever is on your collective gardening minds. But don't go thinking up those questions just yet, because we'll be right back with what you need to do now to prepare for the upcoming emergence of trillions of cicadas. And yes, I just said trillions. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from the Univest Studios at Lehigh Valley Public Media in Bethlehem, PA.
J.L. Hudson Seeds has supported You Bet Your Garden and enthusiastic growers for more than 25 years. To learn more about the world's most eclectic seed company, visit jlhudsonseeds.net.
Welcome back to another thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden from the Univest Studios at Lehigh Valley Public Media in Bethlehem, PA. I am your host, and we are in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, we will announce the upcoming arrival of trillions of periodic cicadas, the ones that have been sleeping underground for 13 or 17 years. Well, we got a 13-year brood and a 17-year brood coming up at the same time, which means you need to protect young trees and perhaps shrubs. Your local extension service will hold your hand and tell you exactly what to do, but we'll also tell you from our angle what you can do to be prepared. It's very important, so don't miss it, and you won't. It's coming up after your fabulous phone call at 888-492-9444. Niaz, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thanks for having me, Mike.
Well, thank you for being had, sir. How you doing?
Doing great. And you?
I'm just ducky. Thanks for asking. Where are you?
I live in Bear, Delaware.
Bear, Delaware? That's like...
Yes, sir.
That's like named after the animal. It's not a nudist camp or anything like that.
Yes. Yes.
All right. What can we do you for?
So, Mike, about 5 years ago, I planted plum, pear, and apple trees in my backyard.
Right.
And I've got good fruit from my pear and apple trees, but I've not eaten a single plum. Yeah. Every spring, I get hundreds and hundreds of flowers on my plum trees, and then I get pea-sized plums that for some reason fall off before reaching maturity. So I wanted to call in and see if you can give me some ideas on what to do about my plum trees.
Well, the mystery here is that the other trees are doing well, so we can assume there's nothing wrong with your soil. You're not over fertilizing. Are these trees mulched with anything?
Yep, I just do a regular mulch every year. I top it off, and I did it this week. And I do not use any fertilizer. All I do is just water them, plentiful water, and that's all the care I give the fruit trees.
Okay, so what kind of mulch?
I just got it at these home improvement stores. Red mulch, Scott's red mulch.
Oh, that's nasty. The only way to use this kind of mulch safely is to leave bare a, oh, I just made a pun because you're in bare. Leave the soil bare for 6 inches around the trunk and then rake the mulch out.
Okay.
So it's between 1 and 2 inches, but as far out as the furthest branches go. Because there's no roots that are working directly beneath the trunk. The roots are all kind of filtering out into the landscape. And if you want to conserve moisture and keep down weeds, that's the way to do it. Don't pile the mulch up against the trunk, but do take it out as far as you're willing to. It also looks great. So now you're having success with apples. Do you thin the apples?
Not much. I prune all my trees in the fall and the early spring, but I do not thin any of the fruit trees. After the season is done, I think that's where I read you can prune your fruit trees.
Yeah, I also read that Elvis is alive and in one of the Chinese weather balloons floating over us all the time. You do not prune anything in the fall. Stop the fall pruning because the trees have already produced their flower buds. I'm surprised you're getting good flowering. You know, the buds are formed on these plants and persist on the plants through the winter. Then they wake up. You can see how early they begin flowering, right? So you can't, there's no way they could have produced that in the spring. So stop the fall pruning. You're stressing the tree. Now, apple trees produce best when you pick off about half of the fruits when they are marble sized. So no matter what's happening, you're going to get better results if you thin your apples. But I think you're going to have to go further. Now, when the tree is covered with these little fruits, are there more of them on the plum than on the apple tree?
Yes.
Okay. All right. I think I got something for you. Pull the mulch back.
Okay.
Don't prune in the fall anymore. When the marbles start to form, really go after it. Take off at least half of those marble-sized fruits. More would be better. You can get rid of three-quarters, and then you'll get full-sized fruits. And the best time for pruning is after the flowers have faded, because then you can see really what's going on, and you're not accidentally cutting off any limbs that would have given you good fruit.
Okay.
You got it?
Excellent. Thanks a lot, Mike.
My pleasure. You watch out for those bears now.
Yeah, will do. Thank you very much.
My pleasure. You take care. Bye-bye. As always, it is now time for the question of the week which we are calling Here Come the Cicadas, or Cicadas if you're British. No kidding. 2020 year is a banner year for the world's most unusual insects. Every summer, we're treated to the emergence and subsequent serenade and bug-eyed scariness of annual cicadas, which, as the name more than implies, appear every year around the same time. Unless somebody cut down the trees they were living under and paved that area, then those ones are out of luck. Periodic cicadas are another story. Individual colonies are classified, using Roman numerals, as broods, and there are two main types. Brood number 19 emerges every 13 years, while the sleeping-in brood, Roman numeral 13, emerges once every 17 years. This year, those two big broods will emerge at the same time, with total numbers in the trillions. Many of you have some noisy summer nights ahead. Oh, and those annual cicadas will also be out and about this summer. Note, the brood numbers do not change over the years. They are and will remain the official way to identify a specific brood. The overall species name for most periodic cicadas is Magiceta, a combination of the words magic and cicada. According to the University of Connecticut's 2024 map, this year's emergence is going to be mostly a southern and midwestern event. South from around Milwaukee down to Kansas, which appears to be ground zero, and Arkansas, then taking a dogleg east to cover most of Georgia, Alabama, and the Carolinas. Then it takes a break and pops up again from Norfolk to Washington, D.C. Your state extension website will have very specific maps for your region. What does this sudden appearance of trillions of weird-looking, buzzing, red-eyed insects mean to you? Plenty if you have young trees. Here's their life cycle. After semi-hibernating for 13 or 17 years, slowly sucking on the roots of plants, the larval forms have gone through several molts, gaining size every time. And then, at the gong of that invisible bell, the next-to-last molt will emerge above ground, looking kind of like a cicada, but white. So, no, you did not discover a rare albino cicada. Sorry. They climb up onto a nearby surface and go through a final molt, leaving their extremely creepy exoskeletons behind, on trees, cars, walls, wherever and everywhere. They need to dry their wings for a few days, then the males go in search of females and mate. This is when your young trees are in danger. After mating, the females cut slits in tree branches in which to lay their 600 or so eggs. They don't eat the branches, but the cutting damage can be severe, especially when there are so many of them. Forget about spraying. Cicadas are not vulnerable. There are just too many of them, and you'd be harming the birds, toads, and other predators that consume them, like the famed cicada-killing wasp. One solution is to cover young trees, especially fruit trees, with insect netting, like a lightweight row cover, until the invasion is over. The labels on some row cover-like products will even be cicada-specific. Others recommend coating young branches with peppermint oil to repel the females. The Morton Arboretum in Illinois, an area due to host lots of cicadas this summer, adds the suggestion not to plant new trees this spring if possible. Leave them out in pots until you hear buzzing, and then cover them with netting or move them to a safe spot indoors. The attack will only last for a few weeks. And come on, fall is a much better time to plant trees than spring anyway. If you're just now thinking about planting new trees and haven't purchased them yet this year, you're in luck. Delay that buying and planting until the end of summer and or you no longer notice the outdoor racket. Scientific interest is high for the 2024 event, with several scholarly books, tons of magazine, newspaper, and journal articles commemorating the event, plus a new graphic novel aimed at kids called Cicada Apocalypse, in which we apparently witness the event through the eyes of some startled squirrels. These periodic emergences were first described in Philadelphia, of course. We did everything first in the 1700s. Following that, naturalists like Jefferson and Franklin started keeping track of the, quote, American locust emergence years. Thankfully, cicadas have no actual connection with true locusts, a form of grasshopper whose huge swarms decimate croplands and anything else they can eat. Native to mostly eastern and midwestern North America, from Canada on down, all of the periodic cicada broods do not emerge in the same year. That would be extremely unsettling. That's why they name these broods, so entomologists can predict the areas of emergence from year to year, which gives farmers and gardeners some time to prepare. My home state of Pennsylvania has seen some monster broods emerge over the last few centuries, but the entomologists predict that I won't encounter a single periodic cicada this year, just a smattering of the every year annuals. The emergence time is mid to late April in warm climates to June in chilly ones. That means it is now time to prepare, especially in regions where the emergence will be so dense you can't read the state name on the overlay map. That's you, Kansas, Missouri, and Iowa. And no, cicadas don't bite. They don't sting. They don't otherwise harm humans or anything else. Their only defense against predators is their sheer numbers. Well, that sure was some helpful information about the upcoming cicada invasion, now wasn't it? Luckily, you can read the vital details over at your leisure or your leisure at the Gardens Alive section of the Gurneys website. That's G-U-R-N-E-Y-S. Just visit that site and click on Garden Resources or type Gurneys plus You Bet Your Garden into your favorite search engine. Special thanks this week to our guest, forager chef Alan Burgo, for his nifty ideas about harvesting your baby pine cones to make delicious non-maple syrup. Once again, Alan's fabulous website is foragerchef.com, and when you go there, search Mugulio, that's M-U-G-O-L-I. Oh, for details on today's discussion and informative photos documenting Alan's foraging for syrup. Yikes, my producer is threatening to poach my pine cones if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 888-492-9444 or send us your email. You're tired, you're poor, you're wretched refuse of a question. Teaming to our garden shore at mikemcg@ptd.net. That's PTD as in Peter Thomas David. Once again, mikemcg@ptd.net. Please include your location. You'll find all of our updated contact information, plus audio of this show, audio and video of previous shows, and links to our internationally renowned podcast. It's all at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. You Bet Your Garden is a public radio show and podcast produced and delivered to you every week from the Univest Studios at Lehigh Valley Public Media in Bethlehem, PA. Our radio show is distributed by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. You Bet Your Garden was created by Mike McGrath. Mike McGrath was created when, as a youngster, he saw the Easter Bunny take off his head after an Easter egg hunt in warm weather. Mommy, Mommy, the Easter Bunny just passed out. Our musical director is Ken Queter. Our chief content officer is Yoni Greenbaum. Our angel of the airways is Christine Dempsey. Our engineer is Cheerly. Cheerly? Cheerful. Charlie Sarah. Our social media director is Amanda Norfleet. Check out her fine work and keep track of our updated contact information at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. And send her pictures of your springtime blooms and blossoms so we can post them at our Facebook page. Our peerless princess of profound production is Jasmine Griffin. Our irreplaceable audio editor is the lovely Jonas Bowen. Our croupier is Tim Fallon. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and I'll be growing spring peas and, of course, biting the ears off of chocolate bunnies until I can see you again next week.